to say, first of all, thank you all for coming. I want to say that although I am very thankful for the organizers, I do not represent or any of the organizations that have that have organized this. And actually, I've come on my own and not endorsed by one of the organizations. There are very many. Because I wanted to give my point of view and my personal experience without having to have a political agenda policy that and policy that have been decided upon before. So and that's also one of the reasons why I am asking for it to share on expenses, because I am not backed by any organization. And the reason that I decided to come out and speak about this is because I felt that there was a huge escalation in the crackdown on activists in Israel. Something that we had not known before. Something that we had known as part of history and had never thought that it would happen again to Jews in Israel, to Jews, to activists that are in Israel. And that's important. When I speak about activists in Israel, I'm not going to speak about Palestinians that are active in the territories. I'm going to speak about Israeli citizens and the crackdown on them. It's also very important to make the difference between the way that Palestinian Israelis are treated and Jewish Israelis are treated in terms of the political ability. One of the things that why is it that important to make that distinction is because, for instance, principals of schools in Palestinian villages and cities, their appointment goes through the Secret Service. The Secret Service has to agree to the appointment of any principal of a school. So that's one, you know, that's one kind of control. But usually, everyone in the peace movement always felt that they would not be targeted for their political action. That whatever they did, it was still under the liberal political rights, and those were respected. Meaning protests, meaning freedom of the press. I mean, people always felt that their editorials would go through, that things would happen. And during these last 3 or 4 months, there has been such an escalation of state violence and state intimidation against activists that I felt that it was really important for people to know this. But I want to start from a different point. I'm the bringer of good news. I know that sounds absolutely crazy when you come to talk about the conflict, and reason being what's going on right now in Gaza, the bombings that were in Sinai. On every side there is just death, destruction, and despair. And most of all, I think that what's really important to know is that there's a lot more resistance to the Sharon government than people know. There's a lot more resistance that's reported about. There's a lot more resistance than Israelis know about. There's a lot more resistance going on, and a lot more people that are trying to get involved, that want to stop the occupation, that are coming to the awareness that this cannot go on, that they want a different policy. And yet, as much as the resistance is growing, the crackdown is growing even deeper. One part of it was really seen with activists coming from different places, parts of the world. I don't know if you've heard of Ann Petter. Ann Petter is a 44-year-old graphic designer from New York City. She worked for companies like Simon & Schuster and all kinds of music companies. She designed covers of CDs and covers of books. Kind of this little woman, 5'4", 110 pounds, that does not look very dangerous. But she arrives on the 23rd of June to Israel, and she's told, as she's coming in by security, that she's been being denied entry because she's a security threat, and that she's going to be put back on the next plane to leave. And she refuses to get back on the plane, and she's taken to a detention center. And I get a call at like 3 o'clock at night or whatever, 3 o'clock in the morning or whatever that was, And the next morning, we petitioned the Tel Aviv Municipal Court that she should be allowed into the country since she was not being allowed entry for political reasons. Because they told her, you're a security threat because you have connections to the ISM, you have connections to the International Solidarity Movement. Now, I'll just backtrack a minute and I'll explain what the International Solidarity Movement does. The International Solidarity Movement has people coming in from all over the world, and what they do is, I think about 60% of their work is demonstration, protest-oriented stuff, and about 40% of their work is humanitarian work, like accompanying teachers to school, carrying water during curfew, things like that. One of the ISM people was riding in ambulances, in Palestinian ambulances, to help them get through. And ISM has never been declared, and this is just important to know, has never been declared a terrorist organization. It is totally committed to nonviolence, and it states that all over the place, and the trainings are about nonviolence, and it's quite amazing, because one of the women that founded the ISM is a woman named Neta Golan. She's now the mother of two children. She lives with her husband, who's Palestinian, in Ramallah. And she and her base for the International Solidarity Movement comes from nonviolent practices, studying Gandhi, studying Thich Nhat Hanh, studying the different methods used in the civil rights movement here. Like riding the buses, the teach-ins, how did people work things out then in the South, and bringing those same methods into Palestine. Now, this wasn't the first attempt at bringing nonviolence into the Palestinian territories, but it's definitely one of the more wide-scale attempts. Now, the ISM doesn't work alone today. It works very closely with a group called Ta'ayush. Ta'ayush is Jewish and Palestinian Israelis that work together to organize protests, some about 30% of humanitarian work. And it works very closely with a small group called Anarchists Against the Wall, who I personally like very, very much. It sounds like a bunch of kids that have decided to write anarchy on their, make anarchy shirts and make posters of Che Guevara and go out. These kids are amazing. I mean, they have managed to create real nonviolent protests in villages that have been completely silent for a long time now. And one of the important things to understand is how difficult it is to get a civil population that has been oppressed to demonstrate nonviolently. This is one of the most difficult things. It takes trust. You need to build trust. You need to build a certain level of understanding, of political understanding, that protest will make a difference, that protest will change, that participation and democratic participation will cause change. Now, this is not an easy... It's not an easy issue, especially when during the time of the Oslo Accords and the Palestinian Authority, there was a complete complacency. Also against what the policies of the Palestinian Authority, who are very oppressive as well. So what we have here is, for the first time, people are rising up against... Right now, it's the building of the wall. That's what's the direct protesting that is happening, and the ISM is working very closely with Ta'ayush, Anarchists Against the Wall, who all have different approaches to things. Some not only politically, but also the different action approach. The Anarchists Against the Wall believe in complete direct action. They believe in no lobbying and no use of the media on a wide scale level, just on a direct level. But they're definitely working together. So Ann Petter is stopped, and we petitioned the court. It took about 1 week to first go and have her first hearing. And during the hearing, the state has to come and say, the reason that they're not letting her in. And there was a reason, but all they said was that she had direct connections to terrorists. But the evidence remains secret. And it has to remain secret because the Secret Service has this evidence that if it will be shown, will be dangerous. I try to keep a straight face. I do. Because you got to see Ann Petter, and you will be able to. If anybody's interested afterwards, I brought with the press all the press cuttings of the last 3 months. The story did hit all over the world because Ann Petter was an American, mainstream, middle class, worked for the Museum of Modern Art and Simon & Schuster, and that could easily be bought into. Just to kind of clear up, secret evidence is being used against Palestinians since the First Intifada. It's a total common practice. It's being used in all military courts. Administrative detention is always based on secret evidence. What happens is that there's an order, either usually signed by an army officer or by the Minister of Defense, that calls for administrative detention. Then there's a possibility to appeal to a judge. And what then happens is that army prosecution or the state prosecution will show the judge secret evidence, and the judge will decide if the military decision was the right decision based on the secret evidence. Now, at no point does a defense lawyer or the person being jailed see the evidence. And I don't know if you know, but in an occupation environment, actually in every environment, any secret evidence is an extremely dangerous tool because you cannot know who has provided that information, what reasons they would have to provide that information, and what it's being and what's going to happen with it. All right, we're back to Ann Petter. And so what happens is Ann Petter tries to fight this idea of use of secret evidence and says, no, I don't agree that you should show secret evidence against me. The only problem is there's a common law ruling. We work very similar to the British system. There's a decision saying that if you do not show secret evidence, that means you have something to that means you have something to hide. So the judge decided that she would be deported, denied entry, and deported. We appealed the Supreme Court. The Supreme Court decided that the secret evidence will be shown to the municipal court judge, and the decision of the municipal court judge, who was for 18 years a military judge, was that Ann Petter had absolutely no connections to terrorists whatsoever, and that she had never had any. She never posed that form of a security threat. However, and this is one of the things that we did was we gave a timeline of all the things that Ann Petter ever did in her life that could correspond to this. And what she had done is she had been a year before in Israel, and she had gone to the West Bank, and she had participated in two demonstrations. One demonstration was in the area of Qalqilia. It was a demonstration where Israelis and Palestinians from both sides of the wall flew helium balloons with a big sign on it that said, "Make peace, no walls." And then the next thing that she participated in was a small demonstration in Anin, a tiny village next to Jenin, where some internationals and people from Anin opened the gate of the wall, into their lands. Now, the reason they did this was for 2 months they had not been allowed into their lands, and one of the negotiations with the army was that they would be allowed to go at least once every 2 days to their lands. Now, this hadn't happened; it hadn't been honored for two months, and that's why they had gone in. So these were the two things that Ann Petter had participated in that had allegedly caused someone to decide in the Secret Service that she was a security threat. And one of the arguments that we made was, you're crying wolf. And by crying wolf, you're putting, everyone in extreme danger. And actually, the Secret Service misuse of this power will cause that when there really is a security threat, no one is going to really believe it. And so, and that was an argument that was paid attention to. That's one of the security arguments. That's within the lanes of security, without even thinking about rights. But one of the things that he did say, and the judge did say, he said, "This woman's camera is a weapon. Therefore, I'm not allowing her into the territories." He did not allow her into the West Bank. He said she wasn't a security threat, yet did not allow her into the West Bank. He said that she could not participate in demonstrations. And the reason being, who is she anyway to participate in demonstrations? And then we asked him, what if she was coming to the demonstration of the 400,000? That's one of the myths in Israel, is a big demonstration that took place in 1982 against the war in Lebanon. It was a huge demonstration where apparently 400,000 people, nobody really knows how many people were there, but apparently 400,000 people came there. And he said, well, if she was coming to join that demonstration, then that would be okay. So then we said, wait a minute. So if she's coming to join peace now, that's all right? Wait a minute. If she's coming to join an environmental thing, then that's okay, but she can't join the ISM? So, and he didn't answer that. One of the things about judges is that anything they say does not go in protocol, so you can't really do anything with that. But he did say, who is she anyway to decide which houses we are to demolish? And, you know, I felt, I didn't say anything because I just wanted, you know, us to win the case and to have her let in, but actually, she does have a say in which houses to demolish, because by international law, house demolitions are not allowed in an occupied area. It's unless there's a total necessary immediate threat coming from that house, but that's not the case. Anyway, in the end, Ann Petter was let in. There were others that weren't let in while she was. She spent 34 days in a detention center to prove she was not a security threat. That finally caught the attention of the media. But what it was to many was a sign of what was going to come. Now, about 1 week ago in Budrus is is this tiny village close to the area of Nialim. It's probably not saying anything, but if it's saying anything to anyone, then that's okay. It's about 1,200 people, very tiny village, that has managed to stop the wall. They've managed to stop the building of the wall by protest. In another village, in the village of Bidu, where there's also been a lot of protests, again, Israelis, international activists, and people from the village, six people have been killed during demonstrations. These are nonviolent demonstrations. When I mean nonviolent, these are demonstrations where stones are not being thrown. Because the army, the minute stones are being thrown, it immediately sees that demonstration as violent and threatening to the soldiers, therefore they're allowed to shoot to kill. That's where we are now. In Budrus, 19 people were arrested, 19 Israelis and internationals were arrested 1 week ago. This is not hitting the press. It's not getting anywhere. And the reason it's not getting anywhere is because when you call up Greg Myrie from the New York Times, or you call up people from the Washington, you know, the different string reporters for Washington Post or others, they have most of their information coming from government sources. Now, why is this true? It's true. Any reporter, any foreign reporter in any country, most of the information the government has, or people working with the government. So he can't sit there and write what a bunch of activists have to say. That's in his eyes. In order to be able to give a full picture, he has to continue this the relationship. Now, what would happen was that it would get in some form, but would get distorted. And the idea was that a nonviolent demonstration would turn into a violent demonstration where soldiers were under, you know, their lives were being threatened, therefore they opened fire. Now, on February 26th, last February, the army for the first time shot at an Israeli demonstrator. They shot at Gil Naamati. He was badly shot in the leg. a kid named Itai Levinsky almost lost his eye from a rubber bullet. Now, this is happening more and more. This wasn't the case 3 or 4 years ago. 3 or 4 years ago, the minute there were Israelis in the crowd, the minute there were, I mean, Jewish Israelis in the crowd, the minute there were internationals in the crowd, these things, they would not get shot at. Today, there's a lot more legitimacy for that. One of the last things that have happened is Tali Pachima. I don't know if you've heard about Tali Pachima. Tali Pachima, I'm just backtracking. Tali Pachima has been detained. She was interrogated by the Secret Service for about 28 days. Every 6 days, she was brought into the court in Petah Tikva to renew her arrest. Also based on secret evidence. After 28 days, there's two choices. One choice is to release her. The other choice is to press charges. But they did neither. What was decided on was that the Minister of Defense would sign a warrant for administrative detention. For 4 months, Tali Pachima would be held without trial, under secret evidence, because she was a danger. Now, Tali Pachima had done some really stupid stuff. She definitely had done some really stupid stuff. She had been stopped by the Secret Service a few times and told by them, listen, we're on you, stop going to Jenin. She continued to go to Jenin. She came in contact with a man named Zacharias Beide, who is part of the Al-Aqsa Brigades. He has taken responsibility for various terrorist attacks. He also runs many educational and social programs. It's a whole range of work there. And what Tali Pachima said, and she said this on she in an interview to a journalist from a Tel Aviv newspaper, she said, "I will protect him with my life. I will be a human shield to Zacharias Beide." Because the army said that they were trying to target and assassinate him. And that's part of policy. That's not something that's hidden or anything. Part of the policy is to take out specifically either by smart bombs or by sometimes it's from helicopters, all different forms of taking out of people So that's a policy. One of the policies is to definitely assassinate people who are seen as leaders, who are seen as planners of terrorist attacks. Now, one of the problems with assassinations, and there's a petition to the Supreme Court about it, is that it's without trial. Again, there's this decision that goes upon, based on Secret Service evidence that is submitted to the cabinet, and the cabinet is the cabinet of which is the defense minister, foreign minister, and prime minister, and they sit there together, look at the secret evidence, and decide who they're going to assassinate. Some of us have been calling that a state terror attack. Because it's very similar to that. You choose a target. You don't really know who's there. Now, this happened in Gaza in 2001. There was a bomb that was put on in the El Daraj neighborhood on Salah Shahade. And Salah Shahade was part of the Hamas. I think it was absolutely definite that there was enough information on him to say that he had planned X or Y attacks. But what happened that night was that a one-ton bomb was dropped on his building, and 12 people were killed, 78 were injured, and about 100 remained homeless. So this is part of the thing. So what Tali Pachima said is, I will be a human shield to Zacharias Beide under if he will be attacked by the state. What was released to the press 1 week was that she was helping to plan a terrorist attack in Kalandia checkpoint near Omala. The next week they had said that she was not going to plan any sort of attack, but that she definitely had connections with people that were violent. Tali Pachim is still in jail. The Supreme Court, it went to the Supreme Court, and Judge Polkacha said, I talked to her lawyer like 3 days ago, and this is what she said. She can go to house arrest, but she has to be under 24-hour surveillance, which she has to pay for by herself. Meaning right now, Tali Fahima is in economic detention. Because if she was rich enough to pay for security guards and cameras, then she would be released. Because that's what it is. But she does not have that kind of money. Tali Pachima comes from a very working class family, from Kiryat Gat. She comes from a very difficult background economically, and she has no support. She can't hold to that. That's why she's going to stay in administrative detention. One of the terrible things that was happening when I was there was a big demonstration in June that took place in Aram. Aram is very, very close to Jerusalem. And it was before the wall went up. Now, just to give a little background about what that means, what happens is that the military brings in big slabs of cement. The big slabs of cement, they're about 8 or 9 meters, that are supposed to go up to build the wall. And what happens is, as they're bringing in the cement, that's when you know that the wall is going to go up for sure. Now, there have been all kinds of different decisions about the wall. There was a decision of the Israeli Supreme Court who decided that the wall was legal because it was for security reasons, but that no, it you needed to cut off that the defense ministry needed to cut off about 40 kilometers of it because of its overall infringement on Palestinian human rights and land and whatever. I say whatever, not because it's not important, I'm just trying to, because everything, this is daily life, this is every day. The whatevers is people not being able to get to their land, not being able to get to their jobs, not being able to get to their schools. That's the whatevers. But that's where we are right now, because we're dealing with, you know, life and death, constantly. And I feel that, for instance, what happened during this demonstration was very demonstrative of what I'm talking about. Now, in the demonstration in Aram in June, it was the end of June, there were about 5,000 people, and I had been invited, this was the first time that this happened, I'd been invited by the different organizations, please come be our lawyer, because we want you to be able to see the arrests so you can talk about them in court. Now, I had usually been in demonstrations, and you know, without that direct thing, but everybody had sat together, the organizations had sat together, and we had realized that the best way that you could defend people was if you knew exactly what happened to them. Because you actually could not believe. If I had not seen it, I probably wouldn't have believed it. I wouldn't have believed what happened that day. Now, 5,000 people march, orchestra, And the Boy Scouts from Aram, like this is one of the like town demonstrations, a bit carnivalish if you'd ask me. And we begin to walk towards the Kalandia checkpoint, and everything is just fine. Everybody's, you know, half the world was there. You know, a lot of university professors, a lot of older people, really 70s, 80s, a lot of young kids. And everybody's walking, and about 5 minutes into the demonstration, from the hill, the border police began to shoot tear gas and shock grenades. By the hundreds, into the crowds. And this was, I don't have it here, I have it in the car. There's the projectile of the tear gas, but it's 5 times stronger than what had been used previously. And it was going into the crowds, people were screaming and yelling, having no idea what to do. Now, the only people, of course, that knew what to do were the anarchists. Which it is funny, but which were handing out onions to everybody. So what was happening was people were biting into onions and giving pieces of this. Now this was like the shopkeepers in the Ram. Everyone were like hiding their heads. People ran into other people's homes. It was crazy. It was absolutely nuts. And after about 10 minutes of these goings on, Niv Goldin from Ta'ayush comes up to the commander of the border police and says to him, are you going to allow us to retreat or what's going to happen? And he says, no, I want to finish this. And he was like looking at him like, what do you mean? Like, just let us, leave. And he said, oh no, just you can stay there for a while. What they did was, which was amazing. I mean, usually, what happens, and this is one of the reasons. It was one thing if you were Palestinian. But the thing is that if you were a Jewish activist, you could always talk to somebody. You could always talk to the police, you could always talk to the army guy, you could always talk to the border police, you always knew somebody that could call somebody else. That's the way it worked. And this was not working. And what happened there were 10 people arrested. 5 of them had blue identity cards, meaning they were Israeli citizens. 5 of them didn't. They were all taken to a police station in Shafat, a really close place called Neve Yaakov. And the 5 people with identity cards were released to 1.5 hours later. The ones with the orange cards, Palestinians that participated in the demonstrations, were put hoods on and how do you say it? Like plastic, they're like little tie plastic. Wraps. Yeah, they're like tie wraps. And they were sitting on the floor in a tiny room behind. And they were pressed charges against. All the Palestinians were pressed charges against. One of them was 13 years old, the other one was 15. And the charges were that they had attacked police and army. And with stones. Now, one of these guys is Muhammad Mansour. He's one of the peacekeepers in Bidu village. He's really well known. Everybody on the Israeli left knows this guy because he's been at it for many, many years. The last thing he would do is throw a stone. Someone who sees himself as very respectable in the community. He would not throw a stone. There's no way. Anyway. And there was footage. The whole thing was filmed. We went into court the next day to try and release them from jail because the police were not ready to release them. And the only thing that actually worked was showing a video that showed Secret Service men, hooded Secret Service men, arrest people with guns to their heads, like this, in the middle of the demonstration. And then the judge kind of went like this and said, wait a minute. What reason was there to arrest them like this? So she did release them, but they are being pressed charged against. Now, that's total discrimination, complete discrimination. That means that if you're Palestinian and you protest, you will face charges, including that you attacked police. But if you're an Israeli citizen, then you will not be pressed charged against. And how did they do this is by using different law for the exact same event. One law is the Israeli law. The Pkudat HaMishtara means the police act, which that's the act talking about demonstrations. And the other one is the emergency regulation that is being used in the territories. So it's by using two different kinds of law on the same event that the possibility of discrimination took place. Anyhow, where that put everyone was very much on the defensive in terms of being an activist today means a lot more than it used to. One of the things that people used to think about these really left is that it's very wishy-washy and doesn't sacrifice very much. But right now that's not the case, and there are more and more and more people that are trying to join and trying to make a difference in various ways. And I'm a big believer in kind of diversity in ways of action and participation. But everyone seems to be under that equation, which Judge Dan Petter, in the case of Ann Petter, he did that very, very simply. He said, Israeli security forces are working against terrorism. Anything they do is to work against terrorism. Anyone obstructing that the forces or anything they do is actually aiding terrorists. And that's the flip-flop side. There you are. You move from, you know, being like me or probably you against government policy. I oppose the Sharon government policy. That does not make me a terrorist. And that, but that argument is not only being pushed home legally or in court, that's being pushed through the media entirely. And that means there's either or. You're either for whatever the army operations are, or you're against it. And if you're against it, then you must be indirectly aiding terrorism. What that does do, I think it's woken up a lot of people on the kind of more center-left that have always seen themselves as very protected, a lot because of, you know, their army service and a lot of people that they knew in the army and things like that. And today that's not helping much either. Especially the refuseniks feel that very, very strongly. I don't know how much you know about the refusers, but the repercussions for refusing are huge at this point. They're not only direct repercussions. They're also people that are losing their jobs. They're losing their, you know, clients, business, things like that. We might think it's a small sacrifice, thinking of what's happening on the whole and on the way to end the conflict. But it's very difficult personally. And so I think that one of the things that can be most supported is if these people are heard, if activists are supported from the outside, if they're heard, and also if they're the most organizing that can be done to bring what's actually happening out. Now, one of the things about I wanted to mention one more case of a man named and the importance of this case, besides it being very important to me personally, I think the importance is also to focus on nonviolent Palestinian activism and the fact that that's growing, and there's many, many, many people that are not using force and not planning to use force, that are teaching nonviolence. I was very fortunate to be able to represent a man named Naim Morar. He's from the Budrus village. Him and his brother were arrested one night at 2 o'clock in the morning by army soldiers who had entered their house. And I went then to the Ofer military court. But first, there's an encampment, so I went to see him, and I was really afraid. It was because, you know, the first thing that you hear, that you think is, oh, you know, he's going to be really badly beaten. And I find him sitting around smiling and whatever. And I say to him, you know, what's up? What's going on? And just by seeing his calmness, and, you know, the way he was serene with things, he said, you know, they are arresting me because I'm organizing the demonstrations in Budrus, and they know this, and so that's the reason for that they're arresting me. And what his job is, he's a sulha maker. He's like a kind of a mediator, dealing mainly with land issues. A lot of you know, there's a It is an agrarian culture in that way. So in the village, a lot of the things that need to be decided upon is whose land is it, who's going to work the land, whose responsibility. He was the peacekeeper. And very, very well respected. The first judge at the military court said, no, there's information about him. Again, this is secret information. There's information about him that shows us that he is a security threat. And then we took it, and then that means that he's going to stay in administrative detention for 6 months. We went to the Ktziot Appeals Court. It's like out in the boondocks, you know, like drive from nowhere. And we found this incredibly courageous judge that wrote in his decision, he accepted our arguments and he wrote in his decision that the first judge had been purposely misled by the Secret Service because the information was not adequate. All he had done was participate and organize political demonstrations, and administrative detention is not allowed to be used as a political tool. Now, that was a pretty big decision because it meant that, at least directly, it could not, they could, you know, that could not be provided. They could not provide information that wasn't true about activists because that would be scrutinized. Naim Moral was just shot in the head a few days ago. It was a rubber bullet, so he's still alive. And I'm hoping that he's going to get better. But one of the things, and I think that if there's one message that I think is really important to get out, is that if nonviolent protest and democratic participation are suppressed, the only way out of that is violence. And the thing is that if you look at the polls, there was just I just read something in The Economist. I didn't read the whole thing, but there was just two things that caught my eye. And there was a poll asking Palestinians what they thought of the Intifada and the possibility of the Intifada to succeed. And it was on decline. It showed how it was declining with the months going by. And the same people, but there was a different poll asking about support for suicide bombings. And it was going up. And if we can actually see that, because you see it in the villages. You can see that when people lose hope, they start looking at the shahidim, they start looking at the martyrs, and that becomes a possibility for people that had decided to be totally nonviolent in their, you know, in their way of protest and in their way of life and the way they spoke about Israelis and the way they spoke about Israel, the way they spoke about peace. So, and one of the reasons that it's so important to stop this total crackdown on dissent is that the only way out of the conflict is by being able to talk to somebody, and that the two sides being able to talk in a respectful way that can stay, and that can be sustainable. And not only are we not there, but right now, the level of fear that the Sharon government has fed the Israelis, the Israelis living inside of Israel, with the media. And what I mean is, I'm going to finish in just a minute or two, and then we'll go to questions. What I mean is, there was an attack in Be'er Sheva about a month ago, on a bus. I think it might have been two buses. And the first thing that was said on the radio was that government sources say that the attacker had come from Hebron, El Khalil, Hebron, is. Government sources say that the attacker has come from Hebron. And then the next day, both papers, both national papers, had on their headline, right? The major headline was Kisham en Gadir, because there is no wall there. Meaning that the attack that took place was because there was no wall in Hebron because it hadn't been built yet. And then the support, that day, the support for the wall was like 80% or something like that. So it's just so easy. And it's also so easy to curl up in a shell. And one of the things that sometimes people get very upset at me about, not using language that is more violently anti-Israeli or anti-Zionist. And the reason that I do it consciously, because I believe deeply that if we do use violent language, and the more force we put into it, I was talking to some people in New York who are advancing on the boycott against financial boycott against Israel, similar to what was used in South Africa. And one of the things I told them is, you use a boycott against Israel, and the first people that are losing their jobs are, first of all, the lowest, you know, the working class in Israel, that are going to be told by the government, you lost your job because some Danish woman wants to stop eating our cookies because we're in the West Bank. And that's how it's going to work. And the more force you pump into it, the more hatred and the more survival feeling that there's going to, you know, there's going to be erupted. And the more force you put into it, the more fuel it is for the Sharon government, who are not only terrible on the security side, but also are trying to run us down a financial path that is extremely destructive. And that even, I think, you know, the Washington Consensus about 8 years ago stopped being a trend in Washington itself. And they're still, you know, running on this track. So I really think that our figures of speech and the way we use things, even though there can be huge anger and right anger, are unhelpful to trying to work out at least an end to the violence, or at least something. Because at this point, that's what we have to do. We have to stop the craziness going on. Now, we'll probably go to questions. If you're interested, I have some new stuff that just came out. But if you feel that you're not getting your information, or you don't have other alternative information sources, I think that the Alternative Information Center does have a lot of information that is very helpful. Sometimes what you'll find is different points of view because of the different writers that have different ideologies. But in terms of facts, they're really good on that. They just came out with this little booklet called The Wall and the Green Line. And it explains why the security element of the wall is actually incoherent with reality and why the wall is not very helpful to stop being attacks or bombings or anything else. Now, they also have this News from Within thing, which sometimes I find interesting. Another thing is the Committee Against Torture put out this booklet. It's about torture between the years 2000 and 2003. One of the things in 1996, there was a petition to the Supreme Court. In 1999, the Supreme Court decided that that torture was illegal in Israel, that it could only be used in very, very extreme cases. That's not being adhered to. And so if you're interested in that aspect of physical torture and the use of torture with the Secret Service, then that's that. And let's just go to questions. If anyone's interested in more website links or links to organizations or legal advice on how to come to Israel and what to say. Now, I want to say the first thing is, first of all, if you're a foreigner, I mean, if you're American or European, and if you're coming in for ISM work, it's good to say that you're you are coming for that. If there's any knowledge about you. Now, anyone who calls up the ISM offices, the media office headquarters, is being monitored. They will have your name. So the minute you call up, that's that. So that it's best not to lie about it, because if you lie about it, then when we go to court, the judge can say, the reason that we're not letting them in is because they lied to the state. But if you say, I'm coming in, I want to visit friends, I have some people I would like to meet, I'm studying for this and this and this, and I also would like to see the activities of the International Solidarity Movement or Ta'ayush or Women in Black or anyone who you want. It's good to kind of put many, many organizations out there, because then it can't be pinpointed. It's always good to know exactly where you're going or someone that you're talking to. Just in general, it's not a great thing to lie, just because they can get you back on it. Now, you don't have to tell your whole life story and what you think about, you know, the territories. Now, if you're Palestinian, this does not apply. And, you know, and if you need any advice on that, you could just come up or we can exchange emails and we could talk about that. But it's very different if you're of Palestinian descent and trying to come into Israel. Okay, and thank you for...